This week's conversation with Gail Patterson of Spiralis Gallery is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org. Each month, EGA offers an expansive roster of creative and educational opportunities for needleworkers around the globe, including the popular virtual lectures. The October lecture is Este de Chato, Mastering Needlework in Mid-19th Century Mexico, with Dr. Lynn Anderson and Dr. Mayela Flores Enriquez on October 14. Registration closes October 12, so sign up quickly. The next lecture is Stitches in Time, Textile Conservation for the Needleworker with Newbie Richardson, and registration for that lecture opens October 16. Use the code FiberTalk5 to get a $5 discount on this and any of the EGA's virtual lectures, including previous recordings. Also, check out the classes that will be offered in the 2024 National Seminar Preserving Needle Art, August 14 to 18. Registration is open now. Join the Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org. Thanks to the EGA for sponsoring Fiber Talk, and now our conversation with Gail Patterson. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, this is going to be a different one, Gail Patterson, the creator and curator for the Spiralis Gallery. Gail, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Oh, this is a story and a half here. Okay, so first, tell us what the gallery is, and then we got to hear how you got there.
Okay. Well, the gallery is representing Afro-Caribbean artists, emerging and mid-career artists, and the secondary lens focuses on outsider art or self-taught artists, you know, artists who have, I think I've always had a special interest in those artists because that art seems to come directly from their soul and not within the lexicon of the classic art world. So that's what the gallery is currently.
Okay. All right. That establishes that part. All right. So now let's back all the way up. You're a career anesthesiologist.
I am.
And that's, you know, that's cool in its own right because we need you.
Thank you. I hope so.
but the volunteer medical work in Haiti, is that what kind of got you connected with this whole world of art?
Well, I'll tell you the way the story unfolded just a little bit. So I have bought my first piece of art in 1990, maybe very early on. And it was a little face by Louisiane Saint-Florent, who's one of the five or six artists in the Saint-Soleil movement in Haiti. And I bought this piece because it just spoke to me. I looked at it and I instantly felt like I was home. I felt like I don't know if it was the colors or if it was the way the girl's face stared at me, just a small piece, but it felt like something I would get such a, you know, frisson of joy looking at every single day of my life. And so I bought that piece. And that was right, you know, when I was a young doctor, starting out. I didn't obviously have a lot of money for collecting, but I decided that, you know, instead of buying a lot of other things, I would spend my money on art collecting. And so I amassed a very large collection of Afro-Caribbean art and primarily Haitian. And I didn't know at the time, although the artist was Haitian, I didn't know at the time that that would catalyze my relationship with Haiti over the years. That would end up becoming an extremely important relationship. Oh, sorry about that. But so that's how I kind of got into it. And then fast forward, let's see, maybe 10 or 12 years, I started doing volunteer medicine in LMIC, which is a low and middle income countries. And I ended up focusing mainly on Haiti. It was something about that country that just drew me in. I found it to be, you know, its fragile beauty, its incredible artistic expression. You know, the whole idea of, like, basically tragedy and joy mixed in the blender of life in equal measure is a very, it started me down that road of going to Haiti. And I started going maybe 20 years ago, and I've been countless times to do volunteer medical work there.
So the art then came first. I thought maybe the art came after the volunteer work.
No, the art had been something that I had always loved art, although I don't have any artistic ability myself. But I had always loved art, and I had always had sort of an affinity for Afro-Caribbean art. And I don't know if it was the vibrant colors or the sort of spiritual and mystical aspect of some of the art, or just the strong figurative work. But I've always loved art. So that was like a long-standing thing. But it's ironic that the first piece I ever bought, which was, like I said, at least 15 years before I ever went on a medical mission, was a Haitian piece.
Yeah. So that speaks to you, which suggests that the culture speaks to you. And what's it like doing volunteer work there? Is it around the clock kind of thing, or you keep kind of a regular schedule? How does that work?
I have volunteered not only in Haiti, but in other places in Africa as well. I've done different things, so I would say that each experience is somewhat different. In the end, for the last umpty-ump years, I've been volunteering with an organization called Innovating Health International in Haiti. And what we do is we basically treat only patients with breast and cervical cancer. And I enjoyed working with women, especially treating women, take care of women, because I think from a public health standpoint, if you look at, you know, developing world countries, if you support the women in those countries in general, they will support the communities. Women tend to be the backbone, you know, the ossature in French, the structure on which all communities are built. And yet they are also one of the most vulnerable. Women and children are the most vulnerable populations there. So I really enjoyed working with this group. And what I did is I helped them set up operating rooms. What it's like is each experience is different. I mean, there's, you know, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, that does a great job in a lot of developing world countries. Mostly, you know, as an anesthesiologist, mostly I worked in the operating room. I both did cases and set up protocols and taught, you know, did knowledge sharing.
Oh, okay. So there's more than just going over there and working in an operating room. There's spreading the knowledge and helping people long term.
Well, I think, you know, in a perfect world, Gary, I think you wouldn't just go somewhere and, just do your trade or your craft. In a perfect world, what you would do is you would share your knowledge and, you would pass it on so that someone else could benefit from that knowledge. And that's kind of what I tried to do within the context of also doing the cases. Because, you know, with Innovating Health International, for example, if they wanted to hire, you know, an anesthesiologist, they had to find one and then they had to pay them. And, so my ability to volunteer and do these cases was, you know, a great, greatly relieved them of that. That financial obligation for patient care.
Right. Gotta find one. Step one.
Not as easy as it is in America sometimes.
So is this work field work, or are you in hospital buildings?
It varies. So, for example, in Haiti, I have worked in a few different hospitals. The operating room that I helped IHI set up was in a freestanding sort of a clinic building, although it's a fully equipped operating room. In some locations, I've been in Liberia, in the Ganta region, which is up in the north of the country. That was it was a structure, but I would not say it was a hospital.
Yeah.
It was more like a clinic. And then, of course, in Haiti, after I went with the University of Maryland shock trauma teams several times after the earthquake in 2010, and that we were operating in tents, basically USAID tents.
Mm.
So it was a little challenging, but, you know, you make do with what you have, and it's quite amazing, you know, how resilient people can be. And it's very uplifting, and it's really strengthened my belief in humanity and its power to, you know, move forward as a group.
Yeah. It's just so cool to be able to do that. And of course, applause for being willing, you know, so many people would not be willing, but to be able to do that and help people who are, you know, I'm sure not able to help themselves in many ways. And, you know, just applause for that. That's just great.
Well, thank you. I mean, I appreciate you saying that. And what I would say to that is that really everyone in, you know, in my situation who's has a skill and is employed, you know, has a certainly has an opportunity. I don't know if I would use the word responsibility, but everyone has an opportunity to share those gifts and talents with the world, whether you're an artist or a doctor or a musician or whatever it is. And, you know, I have to say that it really, again, and I know I keep repeating this, but it has really uplifted me to work in these very difficult situations, because in America, we are, you know, the medical world, we are very used to having a world of excess. And, you know, that is not the case in the vast majority of the world. And I was very grateful for those experiences. And I think I learned a lot more. I got a lot more out of those experiences than I gave.
So then in your downtime, are we looking for art?
So what was interesting is wherever I would go, I would always ask to meet any artists that were there. And, you know, I have bought art, whether it be like from the back of someone's motorbike or, you know, it's really, I have bought art in so many different situations. I have met people in town squares. I remember so distinctly, I was in Liberia in maybe almost 20 years ago, maybe 2006 or seven. And, I asked someone if I could meet an artist, and they said, well, the greatest artist in Liberia is Leslie Lumi. And at the time, you know, this is pre-Ebola and pre a lot of things. But so I said, well, do you know him? And the person said to me, well, I could probably find him. So this is how the developing world works. It's pretty interesting. So he said, the person called me back the next day and said, okay, he's going to meet you like at 2 o'clock in this, I'm going to take you to him. Okay. So, okay. So, you know, I'm there in my scrubs or whatever, I'm all sweaty. And so this person shows up like on a motorbike and I jump on, and he takes me to like a bunch of, you know, Monrovia had gone through it. I mean, Liberia and Sierra Leone had gone through these massive civil wars, and a lot of Monrovia, which is the capital of Liberia, was in rubble. So I'm on the back of this motorbike and I go to this area, which is just rubble. And we're kind of walking down these pathways of like bricks falling down. And, you know, I would say there was a little bit of a stench there, and there were clearly rats running around. And we open onto this courtyard, at which not, you know, still rubble, but there is this artist, Leslie Lumi, this young man with these oil paintings that my jaw dropped. I could not speak looking at his work. It was so extraordinary. He's a palette knife painter. And I bought one, I think, for basically hardly anything. I feel terrible. Whatever he asked for is what I gave him, but it was almost nothing. I rolled it up and took it back in a roll in my suitcase or something like that. And it's been one of my favorite pieces ever. And the circle back around to that story, which is so amazing, is that, you know, 6 to 9 months ago, when I was really getting the gallery up and running, I stalked this man on Facebook, which he doesn't really, you know, he doesn't do. I looked at Facebook and Instagram and email. I tried every venue, and I Instagram messaged him. And a month later, he got back to me. He called me on the telephone. He is currently living out of Liberia for various reasons in a small town in France. And he was the first international artist that signed with the gallery. And I now represent him here. And it is an incredible, incredible joy to work with him. His work is so extraordinary. And yeah, I'm just super excited. I sent him a picture of the piece that I bought from him almost 20 years ago in that, you know, rubble, amidst the rubble. And he immediately said that was one of the favorite pieces I ever created.
Oh,
wow. Such a beautiful story.
Wow. So now he's in France doing art in a not amongst rubble.
Yes, yes. Well, he's outside of Liberia for, you know, he was a, without going into detail, he was also the cartoonist for the national newspaper. He actually is quite a celebrated artist. During the Ebola, he was called upon to do some, you know, do some drawings. And also during the Truth and Reconciliation after the Civil War, he was did some drawings in court. And he's had many CNN interviews. He's a lovely, lovely person and an extraordinary talent. And he is now in France. He needed to leave Liberia. So
yeah,
he's in France now. And we're in wonderful touch. And it's a pleasure to work with him.
Wow, what a story.
Who knew, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So along the way, then, how does this gallery idea formulate itself?
So I would go to these locations and I would meet artists and I would look at really beautiful things that they had created. And I just want to say that I think one of the reasons why I'm very drawn to art is that, you know, art is the only human endeavor that is not transactional, right? You don't eat it or doesn't pay your rent or, you know, you can't sleep on it or there's no essential purpose beyond the expression of the artist and the beauty that that person creates. Whether you like it or hate it or understand it or whether it's beautiful or ugly or whatever it is, it's a statement from the artist's soul directly into the world. And, I think that, you know, I always really appreciated that. And I got to see such amazing things in all these countries. And I thought to myself, well, why do we, I would collect. And then people would say to come to my house and say, wow, where'd you get that? That's amazing. I'd say, well, I got that in, you know, whatever, Guinea or wherever I was, you know. And so I decided that, you know, why can't we try to work to bring some of these artists' voices. I mean, they have a voice. I'm not their voice. I'm just amplifying their voice. And I just want to make that really clear because, you know, I am not speaking for any of these artists. I am just bringing their voice and making it heard and amplifying it, right? And I thought, well, why not start a gallery? So in 2012, I started the gallery and it was kind of right in the wheelhouse of when I was working, you know, so many hours a week, way 40 to 60 in the operating room and trying to start a new gallery business. It was a little overwhelming. And I had the first year I did Art Basel, Miami. I was so lucky to get in there. And then 2013, I did the Outsider Art Fair in New York City. It was an incredible experience. I learned so much. And I was like a sponge, you know, absorbing all of this knowledge and experience. But I really could not sustain working that much. I still had kids at home, you know, we're just going off to college. It was too much. So I put the gallery on hold until I was ready to, you know, move forward with the next phase. And so here we are.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all this time accumulating art, or did you have to put that on hold too?
No. So I continued to.
No way.
No. No. So I continued to collect, and I have really refined my collection almost exclusively over the last 20 years to Haitian art. Now that being said, now I'm starting to work with, you know, a lot of young emerging artists from countries like Nigeria, Zimbabwe, Ghana and some other places. And I'm starting to collect their art because I think it's beautiful and I love it. But I did amass a pretty large collection of really wonderful Haitian art, not just the foundational painters, but some of the bricolage artists, some of the fiber artists, and then some of the newer second generation painters, and then some of the new emerging artists. So I did continue to collect, the collection is mine. The collection is not for sale. The gallery has some pieces that I did purchase, you know, for the gallery at that time. But now really mostly, you know, it's a typical gallery where the artists will bring work on consignment.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now I'm getting a picture of a house where art is everywhere.
if this was alive, you would certainly see art every single room, even the bathrooms in the house have art. It's an excellent time to look at art and contemplate.
So this, so then the gallery now, we've got online, so you have your own collection, and then now you're representing artists and putting, as you get close to making the transition, you're representing them, and then you created this online gallery. How is that working? I mean, obviously those are for sale. What's up there is for sale.
Yes. So, I'm in my mid 60s, so I'm not of the generation that either is as knowledgeable about or as comfortable with an online gallery, let's say, as some of the newer galleries. So, you know, there are a lot of emerging galleries who are very good galleries that are really just online. But I think my wheelhouse is really more of a physical space with an actual display of the art. And, you know, I've always felt that art is a sensual, you know, not sexual, but more of a sensual experience. It's, you have to kind of look at it, you know, feel it, taste it, see it, sit in front of it and decide, do I want to look at this every day? And, you know, I don't think you should buy art for investment, although hopefully you'll buy art that becomes valuable, and that would be a perfect storm. But I think you should buy things that speak to your soul and things that you love. And so I think that requires you to see the actual piece. Now, that being said, as you, I'm sure, are aware, you know, even 10 years ago, places like Artsy and Saatchi Art and those online art marketplaces were non-existent. So in the last, you know, maybe 10 to 12 years in the digital age, the vast majority of art, I believe, is purchased online. But for me, I still prefer to go to galleries, physically see a piece and sit with it and absorb it myself. So I hope to provide that experience to collectors who come into the gallery.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something about when you see it in person, there's a reaction to it generally. I know that, you know, we go to a lot of art galleries, art museums, and when you look, there's some that just draw you across the room. I mean, you have to go look at that. You got to sit in front of it. You got to look at it from all sides. And you can't do that on a screen.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that. And I would say that, let's say that, you know, if you want to collect artist X and you go to a gallery and you have one of his or her pieces, you know, then let's say the gallerist or the, you know, the artist sends you images, I would say that then you would be more comfortable maybe buying a second or third or whatever your 20th piece online. But the first piece you purchase is really best experienced in person. In my opinion, this is just my thought, you know, because it is really very much that organic experience of absorbing the piece, its meaning, its coloration, you know, it's how you feel about it. Is it textural? Is it the colors that appeal to you? You know, is it something you'd like to look at every day?
And I think some of them, like the ones that are fiber, that are textiles, those too, because they're much more dimensional than just like an oil on canvas. You have some that have beads and sequins. You just can't, there's no way to capture that online, I don't believe. I mean, you can get an idea, but there's life to them.
I think that art that is fiber art that has it feels almost like bas-relief sometimes. You know, it has a dimensionality to it. That's why I think I like palette knife painting as well, because I feel like Leslie Lumi is a palette knife painter, and I like that because it has that text, almost a textural component to it. And I do think that is best experienced by looking at the actual piece.
Yeah, absolutely.
The you mentioned somewhere, I don't know the direct quote, but your orientation is people who have not necessarily been formally trained. That art speaks to you more than I think you said the confines of classical art teaching.
So there, So there's a little bit of a debate in the art world now. That so typically that art was called art brut, you know, B-R-U-T within the French, or outsider art. And I think that, and I don't want to speak for the art world, of course, but it seems that right now there's a little controversy about that, in that outsider art implies that there's insider art and outsider art. but I think that there are artists, you know, who go to art school, of course, and who are classically trained in certain techniques. But then there are other artists who classically are considered outsider artists or self-taught artists. And that may be someone who just sat down one day with some paints and just started to let these ideas just come out of their soul onto paper or canvas or cardboard or board or whatever they had. And I find that art to be both somewhat raw in its communication, and I really like it. And it's interesting. there is a foundation called Souls Grown Deep. And that comes from the Langston Hughes poem, you know, "My soul has grown deep like the river." And it's based, I believe, in Atlanta, but it's run by someone who went to the same college that I went to, who's a little bit older than me. But the idea of starting this foundation was to represent artists from the American South that maybe had not been included in the vernacular of the art world. And those artists, you know, use all kinds of media, and it's a very interesting experience to look at what they create. You know, the some of them paint on doors, or some of them do bricolage, which is another thing that I'm like super drawn to, which is the basically creating something with a diverse range of whatever available things you can find. and I think that's like super interesting. I just lost my train of thought there. I'm so sorry.
Well, we've talked to numerous needle artists who, mm-hmm. even formal training, which gives them a foundation or this is the way people say it's done. And then, all right, I have my training. Now I'm going to go do what I want to do.
Right.
And, then the real creativity starts to flow. Okay. You show me what everybody thinks should be done, but, I've got another idea.
Right. Well, I think it's important, you know, even if you're a trained artist and know certain techniques and, you know how to use the palette knife or the, whatever it is that you do. I think it's important to always continue as an artist. And again, I'm not an artist, but I think it's very important that the artists always continue to push their creative boundaries and experiment to put their own, their own spin on things.
Yeah.
And, if you think about it, art started out maybe in the ancient world as a form of, you know, communication, not just decoration, but, you know, you could write on the cave walls of the hunting trips and, you know, in ancient Egypt and whatever. And then in the Middle Ages, you had a lot of, religious art. All the art was really religious. It wasn't really produced for any other purpose. And then, you know, we've come obviously to a time when it's a little hard to define art these days.
Yes.
which I think is a bit of a challenge, but maybe I'm getting a little off topic here. Sorry.
No, you could ask that question easily. Yeah. Yeah. The art that the people you're representing must be some gratification in being able to bring these people, give them visibility, help them share their art where maybe it mm-hmm. wouldn't be so easy for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. So, you know, I'm very middle-aged, so I did not grow up even with personal computing or cell phones or any of those things. But today's world, a lot of art is just both quote-unquote discovered and propagated through Instagram, which is a highly visual and other, you know, maybe other media. But Instagram is a big one, being a highly visual medium. And I think it's always important for a young artist to be working with the gallery if possible, for a few reasons, not the least of which is to be, you know, to have some other pairs of eyes on what's happening, but also to have an opportunity to have a physical place to show your art, and to just to have an opportunity for conversation about, you know, your direction and what you're doing and where you're going and that kind of thing. So, I mean, it's been really incredible. I've been very, very lucky to have four or five young Nigerian artists who have kind of come about, and that relationship has been really good. And I think they're not just talented, but I think their art is really being greatly well received and enjoyed by this area here. And the other thing, you know, I wanted to just mention is that I have found that in this area, I'm in Maryland. I'm on the eastern shore of Maryland, which historically has very significant African American population. But in a lot of the art that one would see in this area, that population was not, that voice was not well represented. And I felt that maybe it would be both interesting and important and informative to bring some more of those voices, hence the Afro-Caribbean, you know, focus of the gallery, to this area. And I think that, you know, people don't know what they don't know, right? So, you know, people, I wasn't sure when I had the first show at Out of the Fire, which is a restaurant and art space in the area, because I didn't have a physical space yet. So I had a show that I hung in that restaurant, and I didn't know how it would be received. And we have been very, very fortunate to have an incredible reception. We sold a lot of things, and people really enjoyed, I think, some of the freshness that it brought, some of the new voices. So it's been great. I'm just overwhelmed with gratitude about how well it went.
Yeah, I've seen restaurants that do that. My experience has been photography, where art photography is hung in a restaurant and available for sale. But what a great way to expose people to an artist or a form of art. How did that? I mean, that's pretty open-minded on a restaurant owner's part too.
Well, So this restaurant is a restaurant / art space. So the owner, who is an extraordinary person, always wanted to support the local artistic community, and so people know who go to this restaurant that there are every 8 to 10 weeks there are changing exhibits. They know that they will see something new. So she had never shown a gallery before, and I've known her for a while now. So I invited her to come to my home, and I pulled maybe 20 pieces, not just what's on the wall, but I pulled maybe 20 pieces to show her, to say that this is kind of what the show would look like. And she said, yeah, I've never done this, but I have to do this. And it's been very, very exciting because, this area tends to be a little, a little bit heavy on the painting, painting. So it's nice to have photography, nice to have some bricolage art, some sculpture, and then some textile art as well, which is, something new. So, we're going to have all different forms in the gallery.
Yeah, we're obviously not a painting podcast here.
Right.
But I've enjoyed, there's several artists that you have. Well, and we talked to Holly Jackson, but who do beads and sequins and fabrics that are pretty amazing.
Yeah, so Holly is a young artist who signed with the gallery. I'm very excited about her work because I think it's very, let me just back up. Her work is very story driven. So I think if you just look at a flat picture, this is why I think you need to come and experience her work. If you look at a flat picture on the website, you don't really fully appreciate the textural nature of what she does and the intricacy. And so she uses ancient embroidery techniques from like the 1600s when women had nothing to do except for they could embroider these little boxes. That was their only form of expression at all, whether it was artistic or anything else. She uses those ancient techniques to address current issues, including women's rights and climate change. And I just found that to be such a refreshing, unusual, but interesting combination. And I think her work is just extraordinary. And I know that she's done a podcast for you as well. So I haven't listened to her podcast yet, actually, but I'm sure it's really great because she's a very thoughtful, interesting artist.
Yeah, we really enjoyed our time with her. She was, does really interesting work. Yeah, it's so fun to see what people can do outside of the mainstream of needlework.
Well, she's one of them. So you mentioned the bead artist. So in Haiti, I really met and worked with two main bead artists that were women. You know, in general, a lot of art, well, through the ages, was done by men, of all kinds of art. And especially, you know, in Africa, a lot of the textile art was done by men. And it wasn't until, you know, within the last 100 or so years, 150 years, that really women have taken over doing a lot of that art. And so, So in Haiti, they do these things called drapeau. So in Creole, drapeau is a flag, and they're called voodoo flags. They are made they're ceremonial flags that are made to call upon the different spirits. And the ones that were made for actual ceremonies are not highly ornate. They're just the images in beadwork on fabric of the various, you know, gods and goddesses that they wanted to call upon in these ceremonies. But they realized not so long ago that there potentially was an art market for these things. And the two, Mireille Delisset and Mirlan Constant, who I've met and have known for really a very long time now, are incredible bead artists, and cousins actually. And the way it's done, the thing that I thought was so extraordinary is that I also have a small collection of quilts, and my mom was from Alabama. And her, you know, her relatives were both from Alabama and Louisiana in the Cajun world. And they would have these quilting bees, and it provided an opportunity for women to gather and sit down together and communicate and talk and share. It provided a community and the warmth of companionship and create something. And, you know, I'm sure you've had other people who are much more knowledgeable about that than me. And I'm sure you know that, you know, during the time of enslavement in our country, which is a shameful thing, many enslaved people would create these quilts that had various patterns on them that would be important in communication.
Yeah.
And so I was fascinated. I have all those quilts from my mom that I love. I've had for a very long time now. She's passed away. But The way those are done in a communal setting by women is very similar to the way that the Haitian beadwork pieces are made. So the artist, Mirlan Constant or Mireille Delisset, will sit and they will draw the sketch of whatever they're doing on a canvas fabric, it'll be put on reverse, like it'll be turned over, and then like on a big, like a quilting table or whatever it is, then various people will sit around there and the beadwork is done upside down. The beads are put on underneath. It's really quite extraordinary. And you don't see the finished piece until they turn it over. It is absolutely unbelievable. And Mirlan Constant is a truly, truly an artist. I mean, her soul is extraordinary. And she has really become quite famous, and not due to me. I mean, I know her, but I did not have anything to do with that, unfortunately for me. but I'm extremely happy for her. There's now a whole book called The Work of Radiance, and she's collected now in museums, and she's unbelievably sought after, highly collected around the world. And her work is incredible. And I just went to a show that was in a gallery in New York City. She's now has New York City gallery representation, and it's just amazing stuff. So even on a small piece, something like, you know, 24 by 24 inches or 24 by 28 inches, there'll be as many as 25,000 hand sewn beads. And on these larger pieces, you know, 5 to 10 people can work on these pieces for weeks. I mean, some of her pieces are like 7 by 9 feet. And the detail is you can't even, I cannot describe the detail. You just have to go online and look at some of them. They're absolutely jaw-dropping.
And they're working it upside down?
Yep. It's really incredible to see. I've been to her atelier in Carrefour Feu in Haiti several times, actually. It's kind of a strange place in the sense that it's at the top of a mountain. You have to hike about 30, 40 minutes up of this mountain to get to where she is. I've been there a few times, several times, and have met her in her atelier, seen her and her family and workers working on these pieces, and it's pretty incredible. Not something, unfortunately, I could do today, given the current situation in Haiti, but I'm very blessed that I had that experience in the past.
Wow. Wow, I can't even imagine that, something of that yeah. size, and you don't see it till it's all done.
It's incredible. But so there, you know, so fiber art, and then she once that the piece is done and beaded, there it's put onto fabric, and then she has like she puts like a rickrack around the side, you know, like around the square or the rectangle of the giant piece, and then there's like usually satin fabric. It's quite amazing. You should probably just Google some of her work. There's only one small piece on my website, but you can look at some of her work online. It's pretty amazing in different galleries and at the Fowler Museum in LA and some other places. But I, you know, I'm starting to get more involved and learn more about fiber art because I think it's. I've always been very drawn to fiber work, and I think it's because one of the aspects that is, I think, so amazing to me as a gallerist and as an art lover is that, you know, like paint is paint, right? Paint is paint in a jar. The artist's mind and soul takes that paint and makes something out of it, right? But fiber and fabric sometimes used to be something else, right? It had another life. And right. So there is an art, African-American artist working who makes these large pieces with out of baby receiving blankets and some other things. But the thing I find so amazing about that is that, you know, there was this blanket held a baby in it at some point, and now it's a piece of art. I just think that the fact that it's not just that you're creating something, but you're taking something that had another life and you're giving it another life. Yeah. You know, it's I love that about fiber art. And I also am like kind of always been very obsessed with collage work. And I have a young collage artist from Zimbabwe who's going to have some pieces in the show upcoming. And that's both paint and pen and ink and fabric. And I think collage work, and I just had, by the way, I have another artist coming. Well, he's already signed with the gallery, a very, very exciting collage artist, American, or he's not American, but he lives in America. And his work is very cool because he uses old books and old papers and then also watercolor. It's a mixture of media that I think is super, makes it super interesting because that when you look at the piece, there's many layers to it. And it's almost like, you know, how you look at a Picasso painting, sometimes the eyes aren't, you know, it's not like there's two eyes and then a nose and a mouth, you know?
Yeah.
So his collage work is like that too. So there's sometimes difference in texture. There's a difference in the depth perception of, you know, maybe one of the eyes is very close, very big, and one is very small. And it's just, it's incredibly interesting. Old manuscripts. And I don't know. I find that just fascinating.
Yeah. History behind the art. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell what is the gallery doing now? I mean, it's online, but you also have a physical space you're working on and exhibits. How are you doing exhibits these days? How can we experience the gallery basically?
So for now, you can certainly go online, and we are adding new artists all the time as they're coming on board. So you can go online. You can click on usually on the landing page, there's a welcome newest artist right now. The newest artist is Hezekiah Obadore, who is a young Nigerian artist who paints only the female forms. And the heads of all of his forms are pots, traditional Nigerian pottery, because he comes from a family of potters. And in the Yoruba culture, the pot has a very important place and the symbolic nature of the pot, both the physical vessel that holds, you know, food or water or whatever it is for the family. And, you know, it's the same, the symbolic vessel that the woman is the vessel of life. It's very interesting stuff. So he's our new artist.
Going through the gallery, that was the one that stopped me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, his pieces are really incredible, and I have all his work now physically. I've actually physically seen it. I just had it stretched, and now it's going to be framed for the show. His pieces are even more extraordinary in person. They're, you know, super interesting. Not challenging like in a bad way, but challenging in a way that makes you say, "Wow, let me get close to that a little bit. Let me look at these decorations on this vessel. Let me read about this artist and, you know, why did he do this?" Right. So, anyway, yeah, he is very visually arresting.
Yes.
So right now you can experience the gallery online. We are, signing a lease this week. So we're going to be opening a physical space in Easton, Maryland, which is on Maryland's Eastern Shore, which is about an hour and a half from the DC area. We kind of draw from the DC, Baltimore, and Philadelphia areas here. We're across the Bay Bridge. We're water, but not beach, right? So it's a very outdoorsy water, you know, the Chesapeake Bay, oysters, crabs, et cetera. And so we're going to have a physical space. And the really super cool thing is that it's going to be two galleries sharing one space, which is composed of three connected but three distinct spaces. And the other partner, my other partner, the other gallery is a fiber artist. And her name is Susan Shower John, and it's SFS Fiber Art. And her work is so, it is literally, it will stop you in your tracks. So what she does is she has gone through many iterations working with wood and then painting, but she not too long ago began to do this fiber art. So when you look at a piece of hers, a large piece, let's say it's, you know, 48 by 48 and you're, you know, 10, 15 feet away, it looks like a giant turtle and you're like, wow, it's kind of cool. It's a turtle, whatever. But as you get closer, as you walk closer, you realize that it is a quilted piece, but the turtle is constructed of thousands and thousands of tiny pieces of distinct fabric, different fabric. And she was in the Smithsonian craft show last year, and her work was just astonishing. People just walked by and just stood there with their mouths open. It's really incredible. And so she is my partner, and I'm so excited to be working with the fiber artist because, you know, there's just so much good fiber art out there to be shown.
Right. Yeah, there is, and sometimes doesn't get the attention that conventional painting and drawing things get, and it needs it.
Well, actually, in the Sunday Times, or maybe it was in Saturday's paper. It might have been in Saturday or Sunday's New York Times. I'll find the article and send it to you. It was a whole article about fiber art is finally getting some of the recognition it deserves.
Mm.
Yes. In the arts and style section. I don't know if you guys saw that, but if you didn't, you should look it up, and I'll try to send it to you on email.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
But I want to say one thing about the gallery. So what's going to be interesting and a little different about the gallery is that, you know, in a perfect world, you know, would I like to sell art and make some money? Oh, well, of course. Well, who wouldn't want that? But the real purpose of the gallery for me is threefold, right? And it's the three C's. The first purpose is connection. I think that I have decided, you know, when I was young, I kind of wanted to wear a cape and save the world. And then I got older and I realized that I wasn't going to save the world, but I was going to make a difference in whatever lives I could touch with whatever skills I had, right? That was my requirement for myself. And I feel like I have tried to do that as to the best of my ability within the confines of, you know, working and, you know, raising my kids and whatever, and being a good citizen of the world. So connection is the first thing. I think that the purpose of this gallery is going to be to connect different people and different cultures, and that maybe people don't see those connections, but the more I have gone to disparate locations, the more I have realized that we are all the same human beings. And we have the same hopes and dreams, the same wants and desires. You know, everyone wants love and their family and peace and safety and all of those things that are not basic human rights to most of the world, but are, in fact, to many people in America. So the gallery hopefully will provide a connection, and especially to some parts of this local community that maybe we're not as connected to as we could be. And, you know, there's a very large Haitian population living in this Delmarva area who largely work in the poultry industry. And those people are not as well connected, maybe, or as they're a little invisible. And I want to make sure that we are aware of them as our fellow human beings in our community. They are our neighbors. Because that's the first thing, connection. The second thing is conversation. And, you know, I think art is, you know, listen, you can love it, you can hate it, you can get it, you can say, I don't get it. You can appreciate it, or you can say, oh, never in my house. Whatever it is, right? As long as it stimulates a human conversation. And I think conversation is the only way that the world has ever changed, right? You have to start with a human conversation, which is the ability to think about something and express those thoughts. And I think that, you know, that is what I want the gallery to be. I want it to be a vehicle for conversation. And, you know, the third thing is community. I want to try to create some community, you know, a place where people can come and, you know, be together. And that may seem trivial, but I think that we are living in a world, we're living in a very fractured world where we have a lot of silo mentality. And I think until we get out of that silo mentality, I mean, geez, if we didn't learn that from COVID, that we are a global connected world, right? We can no longer say that what happens to you, you know, in remote Zimbabwe is not related to me, because it is. Everything is related, and we are all one human family. So I would like to try to have the gallery be a source of community and connection and conversation.
So, yeah.
That's the purpose.
Hey.
And like sell some art too, of course. Yeah,
of course, of course. Now, you referred to an upcoming exhibition. Is that going to be the first one in the actual building, or is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So what we're going to do is Susan and I have decided that if when you walk into the gallery, there's a main space, then you walk up one step to the left and there's a secondary space, and then you walk into the back and there's a whole other gallery. So the main space we're going to alternate every 8 to 10 weeks. So it will provide freshness to your experience. If you're a collector, you know, you don't want to walk by the art gallery and see the same things hanging there year after year after month after month. So every 8 to 10 weeks, there will be a new show, and we are going to alternate. So Susan's fiber art and potentially other fiber artists will be up for 8 to 10 weeks. And the first show is going to be Spiralis, my gallery. So the artist, I haven't 100% figured this out, but the artist will be included, will be some of the Nigerian artists. There will be a collage artist. There will be Holly Jackson's work will be there. There's going to be a photographer from the Canary Islands. There's going to be some Haitian work, and there's going to be some from Zimbabwe, this young textile artist. There's a few other things floating around that I haven't, you know, deals I haven't closed yet, so I won't speak of those, but it's going to be a group show, and the loosely entitled Backbone, or Ossature, which means the structural support on which things are built, and it's going to be focused on women, because women are often the structure on which the world turns.
Do we have a projected date, time frame?
Yes. So the show will be hung the first 2 weeks of October, and it should be up by October 15th. And then the actual opening, you know, the gallery will be open, but the actual grand open of the gallery opening is November 18th. And that the show will be up and running mid-October through the end of the year. So about 10 weeks.
Mm. Road trip, Beth. Road trip.
Oh, yeah. Oh, listen, please. I
just want to go through your house, Gail. I just want to see how you...
Well, I could certainly... Listen, we live here, and we also have a home in New Jersey where I work 3 days a week. And so, yeah, I don't know how we're going to... Yeah, the whole collection is going to have to rotate because, yeah, I'm not getting rid of any of it. And my husband's like, oh, no, yeah, it's time to rotate. And I'm like, yep, time to rotate. So, yes, get the ladder out, hang some new things.
Yeah. And there's that supportive spouse thing that we encounter so often that.
Yeah. I mean, he's great. He's not an artist, and I'm not an artist, but he does certainly appreciate not all of the things that I have collected maybe over the years, but you know, he and I have agreed on some things, and some of the things that he doesn't care for as much, we don't, you know, we hang in places that he doesn't have to look at too much. But yeah, you know, it's interesting. He's very supportive. He's very, very helpful in some of the technical things. It's like he's going to be doing some of the framing, which is like awesome for me, which I'm not good at. And yeah, he's just been wonderful. And, you know, the community has welcomed us here so, so lovely in such a lovely way. And I think I think that the artistic community should not look at new artists or galleries coming in as competition. They should look at it as like, instead of having your business, you're going to double your business because you're going to have more people coming in to look at art, think about art, talk about art, experience art, you know, et cetera. And the gallery, we hope is, in fact, we know is going to end up being, you know, maybe a nidus for some events. There'll be artist talks on October 28th. The collage artist Ernesto Beckford is going to be giving an artist talk about his collage work, which is super interesting. And, we're going to have other events there. So I'm very excited. In fact, I'm very excited.
All right, Gail, thank you. That was fun. Congratulations. Looking forward to what you do with the gallery and you're just helping artists be seen and known is just fantastic. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure to talk about things that have meaning to me with people who have an interest as well. And I invite anyone who wants to come to the gallery in Easton, Maryland, starting in a few weeks when we have the show up. And we're easily accessible from the DC, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Wilmington area. So if you're in this area, by all means, please drop by and see us. We would absolutely love to meet you.
All right. Gail, SpiralisGallery.com. Is that right? Yes. SpiralisGallery.com and Instagram. Follow on Instagram too. Gail, thanks so much. And thanks to everyone for listening.